Welcome to another Breeder Spotlight episode. This session, we take another visit back to speak to Hard Liquor and try and answer some more breeding-specific questions we keep seeing appearing on the Discord. Remember, it's nearly that special time of year again, the 420, the day in every smoker's diary. Head on over to biffbeams.com, where nearly everything on the site will be buy one, get one free, or if not, a huge sale reduction. Roy, great to have you back on, bro.
Yeah, great to be here.
So, my number one question, what's on the deck right now in HL's tents? If you want to tell us.
Yeah, I've got a few things going, but I won't go too deep into it. I've got an autoflower project that's finishing up, and then some other stuff and veg just sort of on standby until this project is finished. But I've got my mutants too. I've got some clones that are re-vegging from my last flowering run, looking through photo periods. Some of them were some Biff strains in there, like the Pure Michigan 2.0 Jats cut in there.
That's been super popular recently.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of the hype on that, and it's been an honor to have the original cut that went into making the S1s.
Yeah. So do you see your mutants as well? Is that the bastard auto and stuff like that?
Yeah, I've got all bastard photo stuff right now that are showing bastards, but I have some auto crossed with photo bastard stuff in the works as well. Those aren't showing the mutation yet until I work it further.
So for the benefit of people that don't know what that is, that strain is, they might think that we're just throwing the word bastard around. Could you explain what that actually is?
Right. Australian bastard cannabis is sort of the name that it was given and is the most common name, and it's shortened to ABC. So it's had other names before, such as bindi weed and manji weed and dizzy weed. There's a lot of different names that came about since it's not particularly new. It's from back in the 90s or so. Yeah. People started messing around with it seriously. So not a lot of people have experienced the plant or even heard of it, but it grows flowers and it just doesn't really look like cannabis while it's in veg.
Its leaves look like rocket to me. It's got a strange leaf structure, isn't it?
They're much smaller leaves, so it does lead to a slower plant, but we're seeing different expressions of smaller leaves, like micro tiny leaves, versus some that might be the size of a 50 cent piece versus a dime.
Cool. So, kind of moving on to kind of breeder talk, I've got like a bunch of questions which are for my benefit as well as anybody else listening, which is usually the way these podcasts work. Is most of the podcasts that I have in mind are usually there so I can do some learning. But I know that you've kind of got a good amount of information to give on here. So first up is, how do you select males?
That's always a great question, and you see people that are getting into breeding asking that a lot. I learned a lot of my knowledge from the podcast, which is another cannabis podcast that focuses on long-form breeder interviews, and each person sort of explains what they're looking for in their males and their process of selecting. So combining all of this information over time and listening to these top breeders, there's a lot of different things to be able to look at with the males that you'd be surprised at how long the list is.
So
getting right into it, I mean, you want to sex them, and as soon as you're seeing the males, you can right away just start seeing the difference between each one. I always like to start with the stem rope. Right in veg, like right when you have your lineup of males, you can rub the stems, whether it's the base of the stem or the top of the stem will be different, or side branches can all have different types of smells. So you can sort of gauge which ones are sort of putting off your favorite smells, or things that it might not even be too specific into terpenes, might more be like how dank it is, you know, because some will
Yeah.
just smell more, you know, and it's like a skunky or veg type of smell, but it's giving out much more of that.
Yeah, my sense of smell's terrible, admittedly. Smoking too much as a kid. And it is when I'm doing those stem rubs, it all just smells different levels of hashy, that hashy kind of smell. But obviously the strength is noticeable. Unless I'm growing something like grapefruit, in which case that kind of stands out.
Yeah, and right from there, I mean, continuing on with the topic of stem rubs is, testing it out when it's going into flower later on and writing those notes. It's always good to have everything, you know, at least written down somewhere or in your head, like remembering. Things will stand out and you'll remember things more and more, but you'll forget more and more things moving forward as a breeder. So I've been trying to write more things down too, you know?
Yeah. And did you
So
do that
it's.
old school in a notebook, or are we talking electronic spreadsheets or something these days?
Certain lists I had do have on my phone, but I do like to have my notebooks.
Yeah.
Like right in my grow, I have a pen, I have multiple pens, and I can write things while everything's lined up and be able to write notes on things while I'm, you know, numbering them. Especially during culling, it's like I can understand which ones were culled, which numbers were culled, just based on my charts and lists.
So when you're doing that culling selection, you know, and you're selecting these males, what doesn't make the grade?
I mean, let's if you said you had, you know, even 3 to 5 males and you wanted to just select for the best couple to see how they start to compete with each other, it's going to be obvious that right at the beginning some of these are going to smell better, or they're going to have a better structure overall, like they have better side branching, or they have tighter internode spacing. These are other ways to check the plants where some of them will be really standing out, especially if you're working from an F1 stock and seeing all these different things coming out of poly hybrids as well.
Yeah. So are you looking for the amount of flowers similar to obviously females? You aren't in those huge big buds. Of course we are. But are you looking for really big flower clusters as well on the males?
Honestly, it really depends on what you're looking for, you know, and I don't want to say, like, I'll say what I'm looking for is the best thing that comes out. But
Yeah.
if you're looking for something that's expressing in a particular way, you know, there are males that end up being more squat, or males that end up being more tall and lanky and bigger internode spacing between the flower clusters, or have more flowers and produce more pollen than other males. There's a lot of factors. I mean, that's this whole conversation is how well are you going to be able to rely on that plant to do what you want it to do in the offspring?
Yeah, that's yeah, because it's racing through my mind when you're talking there. I'm thinking, well, I wonder if the amount of kind of male pollen sacs that are there are going to equate to an equal amount of flower sites. Do you know what I mean? On a female, because that might not be the case. So it's still like
Right,
gamble, isn't it?
you couldn't really say that, you know, it's hard to say with the lack of research, and I, for one, am not a scientist, so it's just based on my experience and listening to other people's experiences. And when if you're growing something that's a Thai landrace male, you're not going to really expect like a squat plant that has
No.
crazy dense male flowers. So if I go around and then I just won't select for Thai plants if I didn't want that trait, but perhaps
Yeah.
that those traits, you know, are aligned with other traits that I'm looking for as far as Landrace sativa type of smoke quality. I'm not really concerned about how dense the clusters of flowers are, but at the same time, If I had multiple males that I flowered out to make my selection, I can pick the ones that perhaps made more flowers, even if they're lanky or some were, shorter internode spacing between the clusters.
And do you
The more that you look at, the better is basically how it goes.
Yeah. And so do you do open pollination then?
A
Or
lot of
you
the
have to do
time
the
I
breeder
choose
plug?
to, yes,
Yeah.
because like this particular round of autos, I ended up using two different males, and one was a little bit quicker than the other. So it's like most likely the majority of the seeds will be pollinated by that quicker male, but I'm not losing any traits of the other male that decided to get bigger and much fatter cluster of colas in one main branch versus this other one that naturally branched on its own.
Yeah. And what about timing? Are you setting your males off at the same time as the females?
Well, with autoflowers, it's really a weird game. It's hit or miss. Like the timing can be weird. And I've experimented with staggering the regular seeds to pull my males and look at them. That's
Yeah.
probably the better bet is to make sure that the male's pollen's dropping, that you can collect it and apply it when the females are ready versus the females being over matured and the males are barely beginning to drop.
Yeah.
You can sort of manipulate this with autos by growing in larger or smaller containers. So if I put reg seeds in a smaller container with an autoflower, typically they'll start to flower faster versus a bigger container. So you can kind of work it that way with autos, but with photoperiods, you can flip the male earlier if you wanted to, but typically the
Yeah.
males will want to flower faster than the females anyways.
Yeah, they should race above, shouldn't they, really? So what about stress testing the plants? Because that's another thing that obviously you're releasing a line, you want it to be herm proof, should we say. You want it to be make sure that it doesn't stress. Is I know it's probably a complex subject, but what would you say was a good best practice on stress testing plants? Or even if you think you should be stress testing, I don't know.
Right, I do believe that stressing the plant is necessary, especially moving forward with making proper selections and breeding. And this does even go back to question one again and how to select males, where I'm utilizing certain stresses on these plants, as far as letting them dry out to the point where they're wilted and water them in and see how fast it takes to for them to recover. So let's say
Yeah.
again you had three or five males. And you do that test on them, and one just, comes back, or one doesn't even wilt, even though it's just as dry as the rest of them.
Yeah.
You see those types of plants show off, and I've seen plants where it takes just 15 or 20 minutes to come back, and they're trying to prey again, versus plants that would take maybe 2 or 3 hours to get their leaves back up from wilting. And a lot of different types of stresses, even with cloning is sort of, I put it in the category of stress and how fast the plant can recover. This cutting can recover without any roots to
Yeah.
continue to live and then put out roots. So you can clone males or even this in regard to female selection, how fast are those cuts wanting to clone? And once they are cloned, how fast are they going to fill up a specific container size with roots before they need to be transplanted again? How fast are drinking is a big one. There's a lot of ways to see what's going on in the root zone without seeing the roots.
Yeah, for sure. And so it's that basically starving those plants of various items along the way, then I imagine. So water, light.
Right, exactly. There's other things to look for in males, like how fast it shows in when you're veggieing it from a seed, how fast it will show its sex, how much it will show its sex. Some will just show sort of a premature nut or whatnot, and not really be a hanging nut. It's some other veg males will just start trying to drop pollen in veg, which I think is not the most,
Yeah.
not the best trait for me. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that, but I've had males that are root bound, underwater, heat stress, cold stress, wind stress, all these different things where they're getting chopped in half and see how much they actually want to show their sex or how much they want to pre-flower.
And so are you suggesting that you're doing a separate stress test from your male and your female, or are you waiting till you've made your cross, selected your male, selected your female, you've bred them, and then you're stressing the actual line of seeds, or are you stressing your males on your selection
I'll
first?
stress the males. I mean, obviously, I
Yeah.
can't clone autoflowers, but those males will
Yeah.
go through getting, dried out and see if they show intersex traits because I have had males show the pistils, they'll grow the hairs, and it's not something that I want to use. And there's an argument about that from, I think, Ethos, and I'm just not sure enough to say, and I'd just rather use something that doesn't show both sexes to pollinate my plants, you know?
So, is there anything else that you'd use for a stress test?
As far as stressing, as even with just trying to select females, there's a long list of stuff, and just going through them pretty quickly. Underwatering, we've talked about a lot. Overwatering is
Yeah.
a big one. Obviously, it's not possible in certain mediums and grow styles, but overwatering will really show you who about the roots and how well they can manage in that type of environment. Because certain cannabis plants do grow in swampy areas really well where they're wet all the time.
Yeah.
Underfeeding them, I mean, underfeeding and overfeeding go hand in hand, and seeing how much the plant can take. Certain plants want to eat more, and I don't really like to select in that realm. I have a specific amount that I like to feed to the plants. And I just sort of follow that guideline. So if this one wants to be particularly feisty with the feeding or how much that is consuming as far as nutrients, it's not something that I'm going to select for.
Right, so
High temps, we've brought that up. Low
yeah.
temps, the cold temps I experience in winter just because I'm in New England, and I don't, do any supplemental heating or space heaters or anything like that. I rely on the heat from the lights.
Yeah.
So it's not very low temperatures where I've seen people throw plants outside in the winter just for a few hours and see how they can recover from that type of stress. Some do and some don't. I mean, it basically looks what you're looking for, where I'm not really concerned about the cold stressing for my indoor plants and things that are set for my indoor genetics, but for my outdoor stuff, it's a different story where perhaps I would go to those extremes and maybe put, ice cubes on the pot, the soil in the container, and let that melt in or
Yeah.
whatnot. And that just for a harvest thing, which I don't really agree with it for like increasing your trichomes or whatever, that's a different story. But I think it is a stressor, and I think it can be utilized. People even shooting screws through the base of their plant. I wouldn't recommend that.
Yeah.
Well, it's a stress. So there's also, in regards to temps and humidity, high humidity and low humidity, those can be dangerous areas for the plant as well. So those are definitely stressors. As far as outdoor in my area, we do get a lot of high humidity days during the end of harvest when you don't really want them. So
Yeah.
it's good to get things that are extremely resistant. Again, you'll find that in cannabis plants. There are certain varieties like Lolab Valley, Lemon Cashmere is a
Yeah.
particular strain that like grows in 80% humidity constantly its whole life cycle and doesn't mold. I mean, it's able to produce seeds as well in this valley, which is, a little bit weird. I think that's a unique special trait that I've been looking into a little bit, where pollen is deactivated with heavy moisture content and high humidity. So it's very unstable typically. If these plants are continuing to pollinate each other and make seeds in 80% humidity all the time, there's got to be some type of special trait in males that allow for that pollen to survive in those high humidity levels.
Yeah, you would have thought, wouldn't you? Especially if it's kind of like the bottom of a valley, like you say, up there with all that moisture. I presume that pollination season would take place still when it's quite humid again. So yeah, be interesting.
Yeah, and right in that realm is a temperature and relative humidity swings. There's ways to fog out the plant or get it really hot, just to see how the plants react in short bursts. And this is something that is something that I don't try to do all the time, but here and again I'll work with that type of stress where it helps mold, helps out, but things like powdery mildew and botrytis take its effect on the plant with those temperature swings. So that's a little bit of a mold resistance type of test as well, and that's something that happens outdoor regularly here. So I would definitely say that's something that's hard to test inside, but there's plenty of other stressors. We'll just continue on with that. We've talked about root bound already, having containers that are too small for the plant where they're drinking constantly and how they'll react to that environment.
Yeah.
There's also the opposite of that, where I've seen guys that are putting not very big plants in gigantic containers. And that's definitely one of those things where some plants really can't handle that, especially if they're younger. And amount of training that you do too, as far as super cropping and heavy defoliation and lollipopping or no lollipopping, and how well, it will recover from those types of things, how much that it likes to be taken off. There was always a rule of thumb about taking off only a specific percentage of the leaves. But I've really seen people go hard and take, 3/4 of the leaves off of the plant and see it recover, within just a few days.
Yeah, you certainly see some people are pretty brutal, aren't they, with the defoliation.
There's different ways to stress with the light. Like putting them under low light and see how they react, or a really intense light where you put your lights really close to them and see, inch by inch how long it takes for the plant to actually start tacoing its leaves or showing negative effects, because some plants can really, really pull it off and they won't look different at all, even if the lights are touching them. Along with the lights is light leaks. Light leaks is a big one, and that's like a common issue for having the plant's herm on people. But if you're really trying to test that stuff, I mean, my tents, aren't taped up all over the seals and everything. I mean, there's bound to be some light leaks, and their herms aren't all the time on everything, especially in the midst of other testings, as well as the combination of all these testings, too. It's like, you're not going to do all these things at once. That's a warning.
No.
I like to test autos too with, this is a good one, the 24 hours of darkness, just kind of in the middle of their cycle, while they're in flower or while they're in veg, and just see how what they do. I mean, some of them really get affected by something like that, and it's something where I don't really want that to be in my genetics if they're gonna really take a negative hit just with one day of darkness. And that's something that it's just keeping in mind of people, who is probably everybody. Your power goes out for the day and you have a storm or the freaking tornadoes down south. I mean, these things are gonna see some type of stress at some point, and the odds are there. So just to test that is seeing what the plant will do. One thing I like to do too is the different types of inputs as far as water, where you can water in with colder water or warmer water and see how the plants react to that. And I feel like that I've got to look into that a little bit more because I feel like it has something to do with the amount of dissolved oxygen with the different temperatures of water. So I'll see how these plants react, where they'll get slightly droopy in a way where the rapid loss of oxygen in the root zone affects them slowly, and then that goes away after about an hour, and then they start purring.
I mean, shock as well, you would have thought, if you're just direct out tap water, you know. It's going to come out, well, certainly where we're at, it comes out pretty damn cold, you know, direct out of the tap. So obviously shock would have something to do with that too.
And we talked a bit about training, and they're all sort of different. Super cropping, I'll probably explain this a little bit, is you're pinching the stems of the plant to bend them over. That way, it takes away its apical dominance, which is just the hormones that make it want to grow straight up. But if you're just topping the plant, that's a whole nother story. That's another different type of stress where you'll see how how it reacts to that type of stress. The topping, I mean, I don't top much unless I'm outdoor with photo periods, but they say not to top autoflowers. And I think it's a hit or miss there. I think some do really well getting topped at the right time, and some just will get completely stunted if it's not the right strains, or if it's not in the right environment, or if it's just not happy to begin with. I wouldn't try to top the autos, but some do well, so it's just about experimenting with that.
Yeah, it's a bit of a lottery, isn't it? With those kind of stresses on autos.
I think there's only the one stress that I was talking about, being able to understand the root zone without seeing it. And one of these last points was multi-potting. Multi-potting the plants is something that's used by Dan Jimmy, who runs Gnome Automatics. He made Anvil, and he does multi-potting, and he actually suggests that with some of his strains for high yield greenhouse or outdoor methods. But that's a good way to see how well the plants are going to get along in the root zone, or which plants are going to actually dominate over other plants. And that's something that I'm incorporating in some of my auto breeding process, actually, in this round.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, because I always multipot autos, especially. And I did it not out of intention for any kind of benefits. It was more because I'm in a small grow area and I want to run a cycle. And so I usually set some more off in some plugs or something first, and then a smaller pot, and then into their main at last. And most of the time people say, oh, you know, start in your finishing pot. But in my experience, as long as you don't let it go too far in the smaller pots and you kind of do it at the right time, it's always been very beneficial for me. So I've always
That's
continued to do it.
another thing that Full Duplex Dan Jimmy is doing with his autoflowers is bringing them to a commercial scale, which is, you know, is always going to be a tough transition with the history of autoflowers. But he's, you know, experimenting with transplanting large amount of autos, so you're starting them in small containers, and then they go out to a field or something like that as well. So I think it needs to be done in the right way, for sure. I think in the right time. Autoflowers are unique in the way that they set their roots and establish what they're going to produce on the top of this leaf.
BiffBeans.com. If you've been listening to Brothers in Farms podcasts and are not already a member of the community, head on over to biffbeans.com, select Discord from the menu, and click Discord Invite to start your journey. biffbeans.com.
So, kind of moving on from stressing then, what do you use for reversing when you're doing reversals?
I've only used silver thiosulfate, STS, and that one I've only really done one reversal on a photoperiod plant. That's something that I'd like to do more reversals once I have line bred more of my work. Yeah. Moving forward, getting in those future generations into a feminized version. I'm definitely a proponent to reg genetics. I love my actual males. So that's something that I have yet to discover as far as experiencing reversing different types of plants myself or using different types of chemicals, because there's also colloidal silver as well as gibberellic acid 3.
Yeah.
So these are things that are pretty common. There's a bunch of guides. I'll say that I used, it was a modified version of the Steemit STS guide, and you can just Google that. And there's an updated version, but it was slightly modified by another breeder that I was talking to a while back.
I've used Belenos's STS off the Biff website, and at first obviously I was kind of hitting the plants with it and I was thinking, is this gonna work or what? But it was pretty prolific actually, so it was pretty damn good.
Yeah, it's an interesting way of breeding, and I'm always excited seeing the fully reversed females where you couldn't even find a pistil in there at all.
Yeah, it's good stuff. So what about pollination tips? Because presumably you said you were open pollinating. So,
well, open pollinating as far as using multiple males and multiple females instead of selecting one plant. I keep the males separate as soon as they start to show, or if I'm flipping them, I keep them in my pollen chamber while I let the females do their thing. And I'm trying to avoid pollinating the females too early because they do produce less. I mean, once they're pollinated, the whole reason they're making these big, beautiful buds is to propagate and get impregnated. So once that occurs, there's not really a good reason to continue to produce so many flowers. I think they say it's like a 50% loss in biomass and how much it produces once it's pollinated.
And so is that, I take it that's from the start of it being pollinated. So you've set the clock off by, potentially you can set the clock off by pollinating it too early, then you're saying, because it's not going to carry on making all those flowers. Yeah,
exactly. So I give my males time to mature because I don't like to use the earlier pollen either. Some of the pre-flower pollen, I just don't think that it's matured as much as a full-blown male colo that's blasting everywhere.
Okay, that's interesting.
The maturity of dropping the pollen, as far as I like to use those nice tops for the most part. So letting those males develop and waiting until the females are at the right point before introducing the males. And then when I introduce the males, I'll be doing cycles of pollination maybe twice a day. I'll be trying to move the males around on the females, or used a brush before and getting all into the females. But I'm only letting them interact with the males for about 5 to 7 days.
Right, okay.
And then I take the males out and I chop them and dry them and, you know, try to collect some pollen after that. But after they're fully pollinated, I'll give it another day or so after the males are gone, and I'll go through and actually clean off all the plants of all the pollen and all the fallen male flowers just by misting them down with water. I'll mist them down quite well, up and down, in and out of that plant, and then I'll be blasting them with fans to try to dry them as quick as I can. This way I don't have any pollen that's continuing to try to move around and continue to pollinate the plant. I just want what set is set, and I move on from that. And from that point, the reason you give a window for the male is to allow all the seeds to be mature at the same time. It's always a pain because now you're growing this plant that's producing seeds, and when you go to harvest, now you have some that are over-ripened, under-ripened, and they're all white, and some that are perfect, but you can't really tell any of them apart between the over-ripened ones. I believe that cannabis will over-ripen the seeds sometimes, and that will lead to germination issues. So when the males are around the females for a few weeks, like some people like to do, I just can't trust that they're all going to be ripened. So when I'm using the plant's energy to ripen seeds, and when I go to harvest and half of them are white seeds, it's just not, it's wasted energy, it seems like, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. That's cool. So how long from, well, you kind of answered that question a little bit. So how long from pollen hitting the flower does it take for the seeds to actually develop?
It varies between plants. And I used to say it was around 4-ish weeks, but some of them, I mean, that's a little bit early for some of the plants, is what I've seen. And I think it does correlate with the flowering time slightly. So the longer flowering plants actually takes a little bit longer to actually mature the seeds, and that's just something that I can't prove. It's just based on experience where chopped too early because all of the plants were ready with their seeds, but this one particular one just wasn't quite there, and I missed out on those genetics, you know?
Yeah.
Due to being sativa dominant or just longer flowering type of hybrid, you don't want them to go too long, in my opinion, because it sucks to run into germination issues with seeds you make.
Yeah.
So I'd say, 4 weeks to about 6 weeks. And it's a good idea to really start checking them at a certain point.
And what are you looking for when you're checking them? For the actual pods to be split and a seed visible, or?
Right. Some of them will split and some of them won't even. I mean, some of the denser ones are just kind of compacted in there.
Yeah.
But you'll see some of that are split that are turning brown. That'll be a good time to, you know, pluck a few of them and try to get in there and see if some of the inside ones are actually matured as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll give you a good idea for sure, just to pull even a whole little branch off and see, you know, the status of the ripeness within that branch. While it's still wet, you can kind of break it up and kind of make the judgment call of when you want to chop it to dry it.
Yeah, that's cool. So the healthy seed selection, you've touched on that already. Obviously the whiter ones, generally the unmature.
Right. And the best way to tell is sort of giving them like a not so hard, but quite firm squeeze. They're kind of hard to bust if they're nice seeds. So you can kind of give them a little bit, or you pinch them, if they're, especially some of the lighter seeds can still be viable. And it's actually strain dependent as well. There's one that produces white seeds all the time, but how the seeds are forming, there's actually like a flaky layer on top of the actual casing. So if you were to take a seed and sort of scrape at it, it's white underneath. This particular seed, the casing falls off much easier and just looks more white and not viable, but the whole pack looked like that and they all germinate. So it depends on the plants too.
Yeah. I think I've had a couple of Belenoss's white grape that were quite white little seeds that, and I looked at them and thought, these don't look great. But they were fine, germinated no problem. So
I got some original Bruce Banner seeds, and they honestly they look horrible.
And but
Like,
they
I don't
germinate
know.
okay, do they? Or
Well, I'll find out once I decide to try them, but they've sat around for a little while. I was just surprised that it looked so bad, and I, you know, just kind of moved on. This was something burned into my memory.
So once you've got your seeds, you've kind of started to shuck them all out. You're doing the labor here of kind of weeding through all of this flower and getting the seeds out. Do you do anything specific with them at that point? Do they need to be dried slightly at all, or what are you doing? Or is it just straight into kind of storage?
They definitely need to be dried. When I'm producing seeds, the ones that are chopped in the plant, I let the plants sort of over dry.
Yeah.
And it makes it a lot easier to bust out the seeds, and those seeds will be dry by the time that the plant's over dried.
Right.
But sometimes when you're sort of testing seeds, I had a buddy that was plucking some seeds from my plant, and he put it right into a vial and like went home with them, and they were like moldy within a few days because it just didn't. I should have warned them. Obviously,
yeah.
I just let them. I let them sit out to dry if they're just from fresh plants. Like some of the outdoor seeds, they produce so many seeds that we're just sort of collecting them as it goes along.
Yeah. So when you're drying these plants, you're drying them exactly the same as a normal person would grow and hang their plants up after chop.
Right, except just a bit longer where it's more crispy. It's had more time to dry and over dry, so it sort of falls apart, sort of like Colorado weed.
Okay, and so are you removing a load of veg before you do that to speed that process up, or are you letting it dry with all the fan leaves and the lot on? It's kind of
yeah, no,
dry
it doesn't need to. I always dry with the fan leaves on just because sometimes the humidity can be low, especially right around this winter time.
Okay.
Doing projects inside is usually through the winter. So I'll leave all the fans on and all the fan leaves and, yeah, dry it like normal. It doesn't really need to look pretty. It's just going to get smashed up after.
Cool. So, and then obviously storage after that. So you've got your dry leaf, you know. I know that you're a big seed collector, so that the kind of are seeds being stored correctly ? Crops up in my mind quite a lot. And I suppose, what do you have a specific way that you store seeds?
Yeah, that's always a good question. I get a lot of people that ask me about that. And some people will say that for long-term storage, and you can store them in the freezer. And that's sort of what they do with all the other seeds. I think there's a big seed bank in the North Pole or something, right? Santa's house.
Yeah.
He's got a huge stash of all these seeds, like in a vault, just in case.
That's right, he has.
So that's one thing that is definitely viable, and one you got to watch out for different types of humidity swings in the freezer. But people have heard them putting them in thermoses and things that are, you know, absolutely airtight with the desiccant packets and stuff in there to make sure that there and no moisture is seeping in. Because the last thing you want is freezer burnt seeds.
Yeah. Have you tried it?
I don't store anything in the freezer just because of the way my collection works. It's constantly in and out. That's a warning that I like to give to people is, you got to understand like how far the seed came from the original breeder. If that person who was the original breeder, you know, decided to store them in the refrigerator until they were sold, and now they get to room temperature, they go to the post office, they're in a maybe hot truck or maybe cold truck, and get to your house, which may be hot or maybe cold, and you get into room temperature, and now you put them in the freezer, and then somebody wants to trade you for them. So now they go to room temperature again, and then all of a sudden they're in a hot place, and now this person's having issues germinating is because of the swing in temperatures.
Yeah, for sure.
So, which is why I say long-term storage, which some seeds, once I make more seeds for myself, and I have actual, you know, stock from some sort of facility in the future, then I'll be looking towards, you know, storing them for long-term. But you also have to take in consideration that there's people out here germinating seeds from the 70s and the 80s that were just in somebody's sock drawer the whole time. And so I have mine. It's really stable temperatures and humidity. It stays at 60 Fahrenheit and 60 humidity percentage. And that's, it goes in and out, sort of staying at room temperature. And I've had certain packs of seeds for quite a few years, and they're still germinate when I want them to. So I would suggest, if you're planning on not keeping them around for a long time, don't put them in the refrigerator or the freezer. The refrigerator can really have issues with the humidity in there too, and getting the moisture content of other things in the fridge. So it's got to be really sealed if you're going to do it that way.
I have a small kind of undercounter fridge, and I used to store my seeds in there, but not switched on. And I left a hydrometer in there, kind of keeping an eye on it. That seemed to work quite well for me. But obviously, I don't store seeds for a very long period of time. But it seemed to hold the temperature a bit more consistent than a room. So there you go.
Yeah, and I like to play with them and look at them and remember things that I have. Because once you have too many things, you know, you forget about this thing. And now it's like I just pulled out specific pack. I got it for my birthday from a good friend. It was a Triangle Kush S1, and it's been on my list and in my sights, but there was a second there that I forgot about it, and I really want to get those in the ground soon.
I just couldn't do it. It would keep me awake at night. It really would, having that many seeds that I just couldn't pop.
that's why I like to give them away. I do a lot of giveaways, and you know, especially people in my state. I definitely like to get the seeds out there into people's hands, because people don't really want, you know, especially as a new grower, you're not going to want to buy $100 pack of seeds where you mess up one time and they all died, and now you're out $100 and more because of all your equipment. A lot of people just end up quitting, where it's like, well, here's some free seeds. Do your best and don't worry about that, you know?
Yeah, no, that's cool. Yeah, and certainly there are people that run out and buy all sorts of shit and make a mess of it to start with. So that's pretty good that you're doing that. So final question, because it's one for me, because it pricked me the other week. And I think I kind of nodded a few of you guys talking about it, but feeding for breeding is kind of my question. Is there a specific, I don't know if you know the answer to this or not, but is there a specific type of feed that you should be doing to produce better quality seeds rather than your normal feed cycles to produce flower? Or what do you do, I suppose?
Right. I was thinking about this recently too, and I actually reverted back to veg-only feed after the pollination had occurred. Once the plants were at the point where I was comfortable with their size, how much they've developed, and they were pollinated for that week, that's when I switched right back to just grow and not adding any of the supplemental bloom stuff or anything like that, just because I don't feel like they need some of those nutrients just to produce seed. And if you think about seeds, they're just more plant material as far as I can tell. I feel like just the veg would work fine, and I didn't really even try to boost the veg at all.
Just
because they're not producing more leaves or anything like that, they don't need a huge amount of veg. It was just like this typical feeding of just a normal veg plant as these are maturing the seeds.
Awesome. Well, I certainly got my questions answered this session, mate, so thank you very much for taking the time out to go through the quiz on that. That's awesome.
And and anyone listening, my Instagram is Closet Medicine, one word.
There you go. Okay, buddy, well, thank you very much. Take care, and I'll speak to you again soon.
Thank you, have a good one.
Take care, buddy. That's it for this episode. Catch you again for more Breeder Talk next time. If you are interested in being a tester for Biff Beans or just want to hang out in a closed community, head on over to the Biff Beans website, click on the link and join the Discord. Thank you.